Welcome to the Gordon Asset Management Podcast.
Simply flooded the system with money.
Yes, we did.
Where does it come from? Do you just print it?
We print it digitally.
When you give people money that don't need it, they feel like they're playing with the house's money. So it actually does resemble a casino.
Give me some of that. Give me some of that money. I want some of that money.
Now, on to the show.
Welcome to the podcast. This is Todd Zempel, and with me, Joe Gordon. Today on the podcast, we invited James Abate. James is Managing Director and Chief Investment Officer at Center Asset Management. He's also the fund manager for the firm Center American Select Equity and Global Listed Infrastructure Funds. So, James, welcome to the show. I hope you are doing well.
Thank you. Same.
Now, James, you are the absolute man of the hour. I mean, your fund, Center American Select Equity, as of May 12th, as per Morningstar, is up over 2%, whereas the rest of the U.S. large cap blend category is down over 16.5%. So obviously, the returns have been pretty stellar in that fund, and it seems like the press has caught on, too. I mean, I've seen you featured in Investor's Business Daily, Business Insider, Wall Street Journal, a number of different publications have highlighted your fund and the great performance over the past few years. That said, before we get into some of the questions that we have, can you provide just a brief overview on the two funds that you manage over at Center Funds?
Great. Thank you for the opportunity. Yes. So Center Funds are a stable of two funds, one of which is the Center American Select Equity Fund. The other is the Center Global Infrastructure Fund. You know, our approach is one to focus in fundamentally, use a bottom-up approach across our investable universes. And what we try to do is be pragmatic, not have any type of permanent industry blinders or permanent bias in terms of portfolios with regard to, you know, opportunities across our investment universe. We let our fundamental bottom-up research guide us to where we see opportunities across the market. And in the American Fund, we try to assemble a dynamic, concentrated 40 to 50 stock portfolio that is geared towards trying to deliver alpha and very strong asymmetrical upside to downside capture ratio, particularly when it's most needed in volatile environments like this year. And I hate to say it, you know, those that we expect going forward. In the infrastructure fund, you know, the key differentiating factors with regard to that is the balanced approach that we use in terms of diversification across regions, all developed countries, and more importantly, trying to be balanced across all the individual industries within infrastructure, including telecommunications, utilities, energy, transportation, and social infrastructure. The real key from our perspective in terms of differentiation from a stock picking perspective is that we consider ourselves what I call quote unquote true value investors. And what I mean by that specifically is that we look at each company through the lens of economic profit or economic value added to determine whether or not a company is creating shareholder wealth by reinvesting properly in its business, or conversely, wisely contracting when opportunities to reinvest in the business are not presenting themselves because of a business cycle slowdown or something that's company specific to the business itself. So we're very focused in terms of blending together a differentiated securities analysis framework that's quite different than the traditional kind of myopic focus just on income statement analysis. We look at all components of cash flows, reinvestment, etc., and then we combine that security selection technique with portfolio construction in a disciplined way, and all in the effort to deliver what we hope are, you know, best in class funds in terms of risk adjusted rates of return.
Well, thanks, James. And I think having that bottom up fundamental approach on investing in the markets really provides a different perspective than what a lot of people hear on the mainstream financial news networks. That said, we'd love to hear your perspective. I know you just published the semi-annual outlook onto your website, centerfunds.com. Can you touch on that outlook and what you're seeing in the markets and economy currently?
Absolutely. And thanks for pointing out what I think is a should be a relatively obvious thing. But for some reason, when you think about growth, it's in our opinions, become distorted and corrupted. And people, I hate to just use a broad brushstroke, but it seems like securities analysis has no longer been something that's been being practiced by the vast majority of our industry. And what I mean specifically by that, and let's just point out the obvious, the one-trick ponies, in terms of funds that literally consider themselves growth, and a lot of them go by the moniker today of, thematic, disruptive, whatever you want to call it. But they're not really looking at earnings growth per se. What they're looking at and have been the beneficiaries of over the last 5 years and have gotten their, kind of clocks cleaned over the last, 1 year almost, is having a complete dependency on PEs expanding or funds or the stocks that they own just re-rating positively, taking advantage of a low cost of capital environment, suppressed interest rates by the Federal Reserve, as well as very strong risk appetites. And clearly, when you have a stock or a company that has no earnings, in fact, negative earnings for the foreseeable future, and you simply change the discount rate in the residual valuation, you take that cost of capital lower, guess what? The valuation goes higher. But it also works the opposite. So as we've seen interest rates rise, people's risk appetites being pulled back in, cost of capital going higher, you see, in essence, PEs basically fall. And if you have, in essence, the bulk of your future earnings in the residual period, 10 years out, if at all, obviously you have a collapse in valuations, basically. So one of the things that we always look at, and I think why we've been successful over different market cycles, is that we always take a look at it and recognize that stock market returns come from four different things: earnings growth, the change in valuation or the rating of stocks, the dividend yield, and the change in net shares outstanding from stock buybacks. Let's ignore dividend yield and stock buybacks because they're not going to have a major impact as we move forward, or nor have they over the last year or two. So that leaves earnings growth and the change in valuation of stocks. And as we talked about over a year ago and continue right now, and we articulated more fully in our spring-summer 2020 market review and outlook, is that this is an environment where, because of monetary policy becoming restrictive, regardless of what the Fed is doing, the market is essentially pricing the risk-free rate of return for us. We don't need the Fed to tell us what to do. And you've seen actually risk appetites pull back in, meaning risk premiums are going higher. In essence, this is an environment where stocks that will tend to do reasonably well or be able to, hold their own, frankly, or capital preservation in a down market, are the companies that can post significant earnings growth that can offset what is going to be, in our opinion, a continuing contraction in the PE multiple on the market. I mean, and that's largely come true. If you look at, the year-to-date change in the stock market, it's down. If you look at just the Russell 1000 growth, it's down, more than 20%. The change in the PE multiple has been greater than that. It's down about 25%. And, there's been a modest uptick in change in EPS. On the Russell 1000 value, same thing. The change in PE is down around 13%. Which is more than dwarf the uptick in positive EPS. So when we look at, where we've positioned ourselves in terms of the fund, clearly the opportunity set has been in energy, materials, industrials. Those are the sectors which are continuing to put up very strong earnings growth, maintaining capital discipline, gaining the being the beneficiaries of asset efficiency and so forth. And these companies actually have had PE, deratings themselves. But the earnings growth has really been absolutely outstanding. So, in sum, one of the things that we've stressed is that this is an environment where you want to be real, you know, real things, food, energy, materials, and the companies that have that capability to basically continue to post solid earnings growth, remain disciplined in terms of capital expansion, and benefit from what we think will be a continued global shortage in commodities. And, you know, frankly, even a defensive type of environment, which we think is starting to emerge in the underlying market as well.
Thanks for that overview. Now, when we look at things from a macro perspective, you know, we see many indicators that are pointing to a potential recession or a slowdown of some sort, maybe stagflation. Obviously, you know, if we enter that type of regime, that has a negative impact on all areas of the economy, including some of the ones you mentioned, materials, industrials, et cetera, et cetera. Now, how do you reconcile these macroeconomic headwinds with the bottom-up fundamental analysis you do when picking stocks for the portfolio?
You know, you point to one of the things that we make explicit in our outlook piece, and we state it, and we said that we think that now is one of the more challenging market outlooks during our careers, mainly because, you know, all the drivers that we talked about in terms of earnings growth, change in valuation, yield, and, you know, buybacks are, you know, potentially neutral, if not headwinds, which is the first time we've seen that in quite some time. I when you mentioned the point of recession, we tend not to, you know, start with the top down, obviously, because we're looking at bottoms up. But one of the things we always try to do is from the bottom up information that we're, you know, obtaining through our research, is we try to paint a mosaic or create a mosaic so that we can articulate, you know, is there, you know, a top down theme that one can, you know, imbue from, you know, what our opportunities are and where we're tilting, you know, at the moment in terms of new ideas into the portfolio and so forth. And I have to say, you know, one of the things that has been a change for us, I think we were way ahead in terms of almost everybody in terms of warning about a stagflationary or higher inflationary environment. You know, we started doing that about 18 months ago. You know, that being said, is that one of the things that we've been seeing, and we make this point in our outlook piece, is that we now are of the belief, you know, consistent with maybe some of the top-down information that you've been talking about, is that the U.S. is likely to see a recession sooner than we expected even just a few months ago. And the reason is not looking at some of the top-down indicators, which may be corroborating what we're now seeing on a bottoms-up perspective, but or beginning with that point, it's essentially looking at some of the information that we're witnessing in the transportation sector, the consumer durable sector, and even in the warehousing industries. And, you know, you combine that with the Federal Reserve tightening monetary policy, the market being ahead of the Federal Reserve, raw material input and labor costs rising, and, you know, put the cherry on top with the war in Ukraine. You know, all these things are creating an environment where you potentially get a broad-based earnings slowdown and a rise in cost of capital, which, you know, typically leads to recession. That being said, we don't have the capital spending excesses that historically are in front of, you know, deep and longer reaching recessions like you had back in 2000, 2001, 2002, or even in 2008. So where you have excesses right now is in inventory, which may lead to a inventory type recession, which tends to be shorter and a bit more shallower than others than CapEx led recessions, at least in terms of indicators of history. So, you know, our view is that what you might see here is a continuation. And I think why we hang on to kind of the opportunity set with regard to some of these commodities remaining robust and the commodity producing companies remaining robust in an environment like that, is that we think the Fed will actually back off perhaps sooner than people anticipate, which to us, given the recent spike that we've seen in the dollar, is likely to reverse course. And in fact, we view that as almost a risk to a lot of segments in the market, meaning that because commodities are priced in dollars, it's likely even in a slowdown type of environment that the prices of oil, metals, and other things that are sensitive to changes in the dollar, combined with obviously the very favorable supply and demand dynamics which are occurring due to the war and just simply lack of capital spending over the last decade, is that these companies will continue, the commodity producing companies will continue to do reasonably or relatively well because pricing of underlying commodities is likely to stay robust if you combine all those ingredients together.
Now, James, this year so far in 2022 has been extremely difficult for investors, right? The broad stock indexes are down, bonds are generally down in a pretty big way. So most people who have had some sort of diversified investment allocation are seeing the losses stack up in their portfolios at this point. So really outside of a few select sectors, a few select stocks, and potentially portfolio hedging, people are hurting pretty bad. Now, I know you've used hedging as a strategy in your portfolio in the past. What are your thoughts on hedging in the current environment?
Yes, we tactically implement hedging for either a portion or the entire notional value of our underlying positions when we feel that option pricing is relatively inexpensive and the markets are complacent, and we'll tactically sell positions on a convex negative move in market. And we entered the year with a put option position on the around a third of the portfolio, which represented our exposure to NASDAQ 100 type names. We had that very sharp drawdown in January, culminating in the big spike in the VIX over 35 and the VolQ, which is the NASDAQ VIX, over 40 on January 24th. We took that opportunity to liquidate those hedges and book the profits. And then we ended up reducing the underlying positions that are exposed towards NASDAQ 100 names. Following that, we have not put a index hedge back on the portfolio. We had a rally off of that low, and then we had another correction in early March, and then rally through the end of March, and now we've had the recent convection correction. We still haven't eclipsed the intraday high on the VIX, which occurred on the 24th of January. Our view is that basically the way this year is going to play itself out is, and maybe even more than a year, is, having lived through the environment of 2000 and 2001, 2002, we think we're in an environment where markets will, stay in a elevated type of volatility regime. So to the extent where, the highs of the VIX recently in terms of a selling trigger have been 35, we think the new high trigger is likely to going to be 45. And what do we mean by that? Is that we think we're kind of in an environment where the market's continuing to digest because earnings are still positive and relatively strong in certain segments of the market. But again, the cost of capital is rising, meaning PE multiples are going to fall across the board. So you get this kind of yin and yang in the marketplace, which means you end up not really going anywhere. And you kind of churn sideways in a very, choppy type of environment, what we call a time correction. And that's going to be interrupted at some point in time by, I think the final washout is still many, many months away. People are thinking about a turnaround in the market, maybe short term here, because as if we kind of follow the parallel of 2000, 2001, expectations of a summer rally, to kind of get back to unch maybe in the market is probably not far-fetched at this point in time. That being said, is that, leadership is changing within the marketplace. And, from the perspective of people expecting, these once high-flying thematic growth stock funds, to kind of somehow come back to life I think all they have to do is go back, and if they didn't live through it, they should do their own homework and history. You know, look at what happened to, you know, Janus funds and the Munder net funds and so forth. And kind of the trigger point is, you know, these stocks, these companies and funds, you know, fell about 80%, you know, from peak to trough, but then they don't come back. This is what people, I think, are missing. When people finally give up on the, you know, kind of the arcs of the world, I hate to quote it, but I mean, that type of thematic disruptive growth names, you know, when they're down 80% and they don't come back for 6-12 months or ever, basically, that's when basically, you know, the bottom will be in and a new bull market will start anew. But in the interim, I think we get this environment where we kind of chop back and forth. And maybe at some point, we're going to get that kind of July 2002 moment where, you know, you get that big waterfall event. So what we're going to do is basically try to be timely, you know, wait for, you know, rallies, wait for the VIX to go back below 20. If we feel that options are inexpensive, you know, at that point in time, we'll basically put them back on tactically, be a seller of them, but maybe at a higher VIX level as we move forward, I think, as we recognize that we think the overall volatility regime has perhaps moved up a little notch here vis-a-vis, you know, what we've experienced over the last decade, excluding the COVID episode.
So, James, this is Joe. Quickly on, before we got into the option thing, I was going to ask a question about, there's a lot of debate about stocks in the energy space and fertilizer stocks, chemical companies, all the commodity type things that you've been talking about. How much longer do you think that is a trade that will work? And I know there's the Putin factor in Ukraine, but it just seems like that there's not any capital misallocation there. I noticed that you now own Petrobras, too. Maybe comment on that.
Yeah, I think, as you pointed out rightly, we tend to let our winners run. And, you know, one of the hardest questions that most fund managers have in answering is, you know, when do you buy and when do you sell a stock? You know, ours is pretty straightforward. It's, we'll buy a stock when the company is doing everything right from a capital allocation standpoint, creating shareholder wealth, and it's a good stock from a valuation perspective. We'll sell a stock when basically it ceases to be doing capital allocation decisions that are long-term wealth creating. So to the extent, again, as you rightly point out, where we start to see, you know, greenfield expansion in any of these industries, whether it's in nitrogen or phosphates or the energy space, you know, at that point, we're going to, you know, basically recognize that the seeds of their own demise is starting to be sown, and we will be, you know, much more, you know, judicious in terms of recognizing that these companies are putting in place, you know, a change in the supply and demand dynamics of their underlying commodity, basically. And we also have to just recognize that companies also can do things correctly, but then have their competitors do things, you know, stupid. And you know, you're only as smart as the dumbest guy in these commodity sectors, and that includes banking as well. But I think, again, you have to go back to basic securities analysis. And we talk about, you know, in this piece, we talk about the asset replacement ratio, and we touched upon it in our last semi-annual report. And we use Exxon and the energy sector as a great example. And the asset replacement ratio, it's a very basic financial ratio. It's simply capital spending divided by depreciation. If you have an asset replacement ratio above one, it simply means that you're growing your business and reinvesting capital at a rate higher than the obsolescence that you have on your balance sheet. And right now, if you look at ExxonMobil, you know, the most recent quarter, the figure on a trailing 12-month basis was, you know, 55%, meaning for every dollar of depreciation, Exxon is spending 55 cents, which means that they're not sowing the seeds of the destructive, you know, environment that they did, you know, heading into the last commodity collapse in 2014, when the asset replacement ratio was around 200%, when they're overinvesting. And you can make that argument for almost every E&P company, you know, globally during that period of time. And this has fallen across the space, basically. And when you look at, you know, even the, you know, the more oily company, you know, the more leveraged companies like APA Corp, you know, they're still spending, you know, 80 cents on the dollar for depreciation. Same thing with Range Resources, which is something, you know, which is barely basically covering its depreciation costs. When historically, it's basically spent 4x depreciation in new wells and new drilling and so forth. And you can make the same argument across the fertilizer space, as well as other agriculture areas like Archer Daniels Midland and Bunge and other companies like that. So, you know, we're going to continue to hold those stocks. We may be trimming some of them as they elevate in price. That's the one time we will sell a name down gradually if we feel valuations have gotten rich. But, you know, frankly, a lot of these stocks still represent very good relative value in the marketplace. And we think that the opportunity or the persistence of excess returns for these companies is going to last a lot longer. In fact, analyst expectations for most of these companies for next year have double-digit sales declines. And given what we're seeing in terms of opportunities for these companies, you know, these companies are going to still be able to post, you know, positive top line and very strong bottom line as they really accrue those efficiencies in terms of better profit margins, better return on capital, and so forth. You know, Petrobras is one company that it's a PBR, the ADR. It's a Brazilian energy company. It's starting to give us a little bit of concern. And in fact, we've actually taken money off the table in that simply because this is a company where you also have to buy political risk and be an analyst of political risk. And with the recent announcement of Lula, who is the former president of Brazil, announcing his candidacy on a formal basis and being well ahead of Bolsonaro at this point in time, we think that the potential for in an environment where there's excess profits and you have a potential reintroduction of a socialist government, you know, in 6 months' time, which seems a very high probability, one needs to take into consideration all those factors. And frankly, there's better opportunities here in the U.S. And I think one of the big surprises that people are not talking about just yet is we're going to have a natural gas shortage in the next 6 to 12 months in the United States. As we now start to basically turn the spigot open for exports of liquefied natural gas into Europe and so forth, we are taking now a domestic market, which has basically been closed, and now opening it up to global pricing. And when you look at pricing in Europe and other places, in essence, U.S. LNG prices are set to explode. And there's been very little, new capacity coming on in the last, 8 years, as we've touched upon with capital spending. So we think that, you know, one of the other additional shocks that people or have not talked about at all is a big spike in natural gas prices as we move into the fall and winter months. And the ramifications for that are going to be, quite startling in our opinion to most people, because it'll outpace even the gains that we've seen in crude oil. And there's going to be some significant stock winners in that kind of environment, the gassy names. And we think EQT and Range Resources are going to be big beneficiaries of that natural gas spike that we anticipate in the fall months.
On to the metals. I noticed also you own Sibanye-Stillwater. Can you tell us what attracted you there?
It really had to do with more of an opportunity to recognize that the Russian export of palladium was in essence halted. And Russia is responsible for the export of about 40% of the world's palladium. And SBSW is actually one of the other major producers, both in South Africa and in the United States, of palladium. So the opportunity set for that company, as well as the fact that it's trading at a very, very, very cheap, valuation multiple, you know, presents opportunity. But again, like Petrobras, one of the key things that we have to recognize is the political risk, obviously, of companies that are operating in that type of environment. So, Again, that's a name where we have to be very, very holistic in our analysis and not just look at, you know, what's happening in the industry of the company, but also take into consideration what we call external influences on economic profit. And in this case, it's, you know, political risk that we need to take full consideration of. And that has to, that helps in our sizing of the position in terms of risk opportunity that we see.
Now, switching gears a little bit, in your market review and outlook, you wrote about having a preference towards stocks that have sustainable dividends versus companies that are utilizing stock buybacks. Can you speak to your thoughts there?
Yes, absolutely. I think one of the things that somehow gets missed is, you know, people look at buybacks as this panacea, and it's almost as companies announce stock buybacks, it's almost like the seal like reaction on Wall Street clapping, you know, regardless of whether or not a buyback makes sense for a company. If we have a company that's generating very significant excess rates of return on capital, when they announce a stock buyback, we actually take a more jaundiced view and say, well, why do I want the money? Because when this company can compound it at a rate of return much higher than its cost of capital, which is essentially what you get when you get money back from an individual company. I think more importantly, however, and the point that we raise within the insight piece is that buybacks are cyclical. And unfortunately, they're not counter-cyclical, meaning that when you look at the evidence for stock buybacks, particularly over the last 10 years, is that vast majority of buybacks are not going towards reducing share counts. In fact, they're basically just being a closeted wealth transfer from shareholders to company managements. And, you know, the reality is, you know, it's basically used to buttress the dilution effects from very aggressive stock option grants to companies that, you know, are, you know, overly rewarding their executives in our behalf. I think more importantly, though, when you look at kind of cash returns, and this is something that people look at, and people talk about cash yield, which is a combination of the dividend yield, which tends to be relatively stable, and the buyback proportionality, which is a compounding effect. Is if you look at recessionary environments, and you know, looking, you know, not just at what happened, you know, during the COVID environment, but more importantly during the longer, you know, duration financial crisis in 08 and 09, you see them. A lot of companies, in fact, most companies, just simply, you know, stop their buyback programs. They maintain the dividends, but they essentially eliminate the buyback. So just when the stocks are depressed, and they can buy back their shares cheaply, companies tend not to do it. They tend to be the most aggressive buyers of their own stock at price highs when things are going well. And boards only get concerned when basically the overall environment starts to contract to a certain degree. So our view is, when people are talking about yield, we would urge people, particularly if we're headed towards a recessionary type environment, however deep or however shallow that we anticipate, is that look at just what the dividend yield is as your foundation in terms of cash yield. Anything, you know, from a stock buyback supplementing that dividend yield is something that should be taken with a grain of salt and essentially normalized to reflect the fact that many of the companies that have buybacks actually abandon them during periods of economic or industry stress.
You seem to be really a history buff on the stock market and reading this missive you just posted. I had long forgotten that one of the catalysts to the 1982 bull market starting was that the SEC had previously outlawed buybacks forever, and they actually then granted them. So can you comment on that? Was that really a major catalyst in the 82 bull market?
Yeah, I think it was. And I tend to be a bit of an amateur historian, and I one of my great enjoyments is to read. I'm probably the last guy who buys hardcover books on Amazon. my library at home is run out of space to the point where I'm stacking books on the floor. But, you know, when it comes to the market and market history, you know, 1982 was the, you know, the start of the great bull market. It had really two trends. One was the, you know, the change in inflation and the change. It was really the beginning of the disinflationary environment after the inflationary period that began in the 1966-67 period all the way through, you know, 81, 82. So it was the disinflationary environment combined with a stock ownership mentality, which ushered in an environment of liberal stock option grants and other dynamics, the whole, you know, buyout frenzy, which made managers much more accountable in terms of share performance and so forth. And again, as you rightly point out, Joe, the SEC changed its policy to allow companies to, you know, enact stock buybacks when they had been, frankly, illegal through most of the 20th century because they were viewed as a form of stock market manipulation.
And then you fast forward to 2000, 2002. It seems like you, if you had to pick a period in history that today's market feels like it's almost like you're talking that it looks and feels a lot about 2000, 2002 when the tech bubble burst. And, you know, value investing was dead. No one even seemed to mention value investing at all. And people bragged about the market cap of certain internet companies like Cisco and so forth being worth so much more than the regular meat and potatoes blue chip companies of the past. So is that an accurate assessment?
That's absolutely spot on. And I think the key here is that that people should really take away from our insight piece using, you know, the 2000 through 2002 environment as an analog. And again, nothing is ever going to be, you know, exact, obviously, in terms of where we are. I would argue, you know, the problem today is that the valuation situation is actually worse than it was back then, simply because valuation excesses were, I would say, quite limited to the internet and technology stocks in general back then, whereas today you can make the case that we're kind of like in the everything bubble to a certain degree, except for maybe, you know, certain segments of the market, namely, you know, the real things that we talked about, like food, energy, materials, and so forth. But the real key that I think people should take away from in terms of trying to draw an analog and having managed money through that period of time, both on the up and the down, was that things are going to move slowly. Now, maybe things get sped up a little bit here, but, you know, we the correction which began in the tech stock world, you know, in March, April of 2000, didn't conclude until, you know, March of 2003. I would argue that we kind of had that double dip from the July 2002 lows to March 2003 because of the Iraq invasion. And if the Iraq invasion didn't create more uncertainty at that point in time, the July 2002 lows probably would have held, basically. But, you know, this kind of, slow, slippery, you know, downward, you know, movement in the NASDAQ and other areas of the market, I think has persistence. And it's going to be, you know, people who kind of, you know, bought Rivian or, you know, all these other kind of, you know, thematic stocks and so forth, based upon the belief that they're going to, you know, change the world and so forth, have to, you know, just go back and look at what, you know, funds at that point in time. And, you know, I remember, you know, funds like Munder Net and Janus 20 being just as hot and getting just as much publicity as ARK does today. But, you know, those funds went down 80% over a long period of time, and then they flatline. There's no bounce. It's over. So I think until people start to come to the conclusion that the investment landscape has permanently changed, we're going to stay in this kind of, you know, downward market, akin to what happened during that period of time. There's going to be rallies that kind of reverse the declines, which is why it's a tough environment to put options on, because in essence, you know, unless you get, aside from the, you know, the major drawdown periods, you kind of just, you know, go sideways, but you stay within this 10% range down and up 10%, which is very, very challenging for any active manager, you know, in a kind of environment like that. But again, you know, I don't think the 08, 09 environment is comparable whatsoever. I think you're right, though, but that, you know, the 2000 to 2002 deflation of, or the deflating of the valuation excesses that existed through 1999 because of, you know, bad monetary policy and just extreme risk appetite, you know, abandonment, you know, or risk abandonment is something that's going to play itself out over the next, you know, 12 to 18 months.
Yeah, I think for our listeners, it's also worth noting that the Russell 1000 growth on memory had a flat or negative return for 10 years. I don't remember if it was 2000 to 2009 or 2001 to 2010, but it basically did nothing.
And yeah, point to point. Absolutely. That's right. Absolutely.
One other famous manager from that era that I know you know, and he's been resurrected. He's been on TV recently. It's Kevin Landis, who ran First Hand Technology Fund. They were another Munder net that lost 100% over that period.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that I always keep telling people is, you know, and the point that we raise is we think the unwinding, and the statement that we talk about is that we think the unwinding of this unprecedented misallocation of capital, you know, over the past decade, away from real durable assets and towards intangible asset-only companies, which unfortunately have sky-high valuations, very high replacement risk, and negligible societal benefit, you know, still has persistence. And, you know, the shift away from these investment themes is not going to be transitory. And, you know, when having lived through the, you know, ebags.com and etoys.com, when people kind of dressed up mundane consumer cyclical stocks by slapping a .com label on the end and all of a sudden getting a you know, a technology type valuation attached to them, and watching that whole thing just disappear and most of those companies just go out of business. You know, you kind of think about the environment today where, you know, people somehow apply this kind of growth mentality. It started with WeWork, you know, a company that buys office buildings that were bought by its founder, actually, and then leases them to the company, which was criminal on its own behalf. You know, real estate in metropolitan areas was now a technology company. And now we're trying to, you know, people try to convince us that a bunch of guys in New York driving around on bicycles delivering food is a technology company. I mean, you just, you know, sometimes you feel like the only, you know, the one-eyed blind man. And it's just like, you know, what am I seeing that is just different than other people? And that's where having a very strong foundational, you know, basics in analysis and staying grounded in that and allowing you to kind of live through kind of the silly periods, but also in the down periods when things become so pessimistic, which, you know, at some point they probably will, you know, give you that ability to kind of, you know, stay away from kind of the crowd at a point in time. And that's what creates great alpha opportunities, both, you know, at mainly at the turning points, because you can stay disciplined and both recognizing things are just silly at the top and also they're just overly pessimistic at the bottom.
Agreed. Well, James, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate you coming on.
My pleasure. And thank you.
If you'd like more information about James or the funds he manages, you can check them out at centerfunds.com. That's C-E-N-T-R-E funds.com. Or if you have questions for us, wealthqb.com. My raps are raw. I dribble like a basketball.
Slobber on myself. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, be sure to click subscribe. Gordon Asset Management, LLC is a registered investment advisor. For more information about our firm, please visit wealthqb.com. The information in this podcast is presented for educational and entertainment purposes only and is subject to change without notice. Opinions expressed are those of the participants and don't necessarily reflect those of Gordon Asset Management LLC, its producers, hosts, or guests. Information presented should not be construed as tax, legal, or investment advice, or a recommendation or solicitation for the sale of any product or strategy. Listeners are encouraged to seek advice from qualified professionals to determine whether any information presented may be suitable for their specific situation. Investments involve risks. Neither Gordon Asset Management LLC nor its podcast participants shall be liable for losses resulting from decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on this podcast.